You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Ellen Schwamm Brodkey. She is here representing one of my very favorite writers and a person who was a dear, although brief, friend, Harold Brodkey. His journal, This Wild Darkness, The Story of My Death, was recently published by Metropolitan Books. Ellen Brodkey lived with Harold for 17 years and has been serving most recently as the editor of his posthumous work. Now, listeners who have been hearing Bookworm for many years heard these words on December 27th, 91. They were the end of my second interview with Harold Brodkey. I wanted to ask you a final question.
He's not an innocent.
This is a dangerous one. And it seemed to me, you know, after my God knows how many reading of the opening passages of The Runaway Soul, that between the body imagining a mind and a mind imagining a body, the enormous amounts of mutual interprojection that go on in the book, that what is between them is the runaway soul. I wanted to ask about your title.
Why didn't you start with this?
Well, you know, I'm a lazy person.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, an idea is always somewhat bigger than the expression of it. But I can't even say you're on the right track. That's sort of the center of what I was thinking of. The runaway soul means pretty much what you think it does, but it has aspects. When I was growing up, to be a runaway was to subject yourself to a certain kind of sexual danger. Boys got raped by tramps, and girls got raped by practically anybody who wanted to, if they weren't protected. But you ran away to join the circus, and this was, or you ran away to do this or the other thing. But my particular form of it is to run away to join the circus, or to run away to enter the movies, or something like that. The controlling image is to leave the middle class, to, or if you come from a working class, to leave the working class, but to leave your background and to leave the past, to leave your expectations, to be naked in a certain sense and without protection under a rather large sky and with a great many possibilities, some of them horrendous. It's possibly a sentimental version of dealing with that terror and nausea that Kafka evokes. And there's a relationship, obviously, between birth, being thrown out into the world. And even if I'm almost the opposite of Beckett, there's a relationship clearly between the runaway soul and the tramps and waiting for Godot and the end game. I mean, the places where I do join onto, or I'm grafted onto, or grafted myself onto the literary tradition, or tried to, are quite clear. One of the easy ways to figure out the runaway soul is just to translate it into French. My French accent is so bad, I hesitate to do it, but the word for runaway is fugitive or fugitif. And just think of all the things when you were growing up, all the meanings of fugitive. I was a fugitive from a chain gang, but also the fugitive moment. And never mind.
Thank you. I could talk to you really forever. I'm glad to have begun this conversation.
Yeah, me too. But are we off the air yet?
We're going to be off the air soon. My associate producer...
That was Harold Brodkey on December 27th, 1991. On January 26th, 1996, Harold Brodkey died of AIDS.
his memoir of his encounter with AIDS began to appear in The New Yorker while he was still alive. The complete journal has been published as This Wild Darkness, The Story of My Death, from Metropolitan Books. His wife and editor and helpmate and companion, Ellen Schwam Brodke. Ellen Brodke is here with me. And I wanted to begin by talking to you about that sense that was constant in Harold about leaving the middle class, an American desire, first of all, but not to leave the middle class for the upper class, which is the way most people do, but to leave the middle class, as he says, for nakedness. The doctor, Dr. Barry Hartman, Barry in the book, says that middle class people do not announce their AIDS diagnosis to the world, and middle class people, furthermore, do not buy their drugs, their AZT, at the local drugstore. They go to one in a different vicinity. Obviously, these are things that Harold refused, and I wondered if you could speak about this relation to the middle class.
I think I can. Harold liked certain middle class comforts, and he liked being part of the middle class when he wanted to be part of the middle class, but essentially, he was the freest person I've ever known, and he was free because he refused to lie, which was why he was always in trouble everywhere and why he was such an irritant to so many people, why he was loved by so many people, and why essentially he was a destabilizer in any situation in which he found himself. So that we had decided, both of us, that it was simply too exhausting to lie, apart from his ethical and moral objections to it, that it would have been worse than the illness to have to lie about it. I went to the drugstore in the other neighborhood just once before we had told anyone, because we didn't want the neighbors and the local merchants that I dealt with to know before our family knew. But as soon as Harold had enough strength, we told the children, and he wrote the first piece, which actually had started out as a letter to Tina Brown of The New Yorker explaining his predicament. Once that was out there, he was greatly relieved and free to be himself again. The thing he dreaded most by telling the world that he had AIDS was that he would be then treated like an object and not like the person that he still was, with the life he still had to lead.
Harold Brodke is the author, in order, of First Love and Other Sorrows, Stories in an Almost Classical Mode, The Runaway Soul, and Profane Friendship. And, you know, everything about Harold is anomalous. That is to say, you know, he begins life as someone with two sets of parents fairly early on, and with a trauma separating the two sets of parents. As a liver of life, he begins as a non-speaker subsequent to the original trauma. In the same way that after having published his first book, he goes through another enormous silence before publishing a second book, as if silence is the result of any catastrophe, in his case, the publishing of a book, which makes perfect sense if one knew him. I wonder now, one begins this book with the biggest anomaly of all, the announcement that Harold's last homosexual contact had taken place 20 years before his diagnosis. This, of course, when it was announced in The New Yorker, threw people into an uproar, both a fear on the one hand, do we really have to be living through 20 years of possible fear, and indignation. No, surely he's lying, was a common response. I wondered, could you tell me about that, and what was your response to these responses?
Well, first, I just want to correct what has entered mythology about Harold, that there was this endless silence. The fact is that he was publishing in The New Yorker regularly from the 50s until his death. He did not choose to have the stories collected until he could have them collected and printed in the form in which he wanted them done. And that was not an easy thing to achieve because people seemed to enjoy editing him rather too much for his taste. The other issue of the time frame, I think we finally came to the conclusion that 1977, late 1976, 77, was his final homosexual contact. He was diagnosed in 93, but he was ill in late 92. We were in Venice and in Berlin, and he was sick. That's rather less than 20 years. But in fact, today, 14 or 15 years is not a very long... There are enough people who've carried the virus for that length of time, but I agree that it's still an anomalous situation, as everything was for Harold. There's really nothing to say to people who want to play those games of knowing about your life when they don't know or guessing or wanting to tear down whatever it is they perceive that you had. Harold used to warn me when we first met that we could not hold hands in public, we could not look at one another with great affection across a room, because we would have nothing but trouble if we did, from others who were interested in destroying these kinds of things. I was sort of horrified that this might be the case, but I think it proved out to be the case. I simply don't answer. I think that I know what I know, and everyone who was close to us knows what they know, and there's no answer to that. You can't. I mean, whatever you say is suspect anyway. So I think my behavior from the time I discovered, along with Harold at the same moment that he had AIDS, until his death and now, should be, you know, evidence enough for those who are looking for the truth.
To me, Harold Brodkey was an incontestably brilliant writer, by which I mean the shaper of language into sentences and sentences into mirrors of perception, and these mirrors of a sort that had not been looked into before. That Harold mirrored perception in a way that perception had not been previously been understood, and that this was both the genius and the difficulty of his work. Because it seems to me that Harold found a way to render in sentences the processes that go on in the mind when the mind is not completely aware of what it is thinking. In other words, the places where the mind carries thought willy-nilly beyond one's conscious control, so that Harold's sentences include consciousness but are not exclusively sentences of perception and consciousness, but rather oceanic. Mm-hmm. They contain conscious consciousness the way a raft might be on the water, and that this was frequently the metaphor for Harold of the container of what we know in what it is possible to think.
I think that Harold spent years, those years when everyone says he was silent, looking for a structure large enough to contain his thoughts on this subject, a structure that he could use in fiction. And I think he found it when he discovered Wittgenstein, for one thing. He believed in a motionful world and that everything in it was constantly in motion. And I think that the notion of an ocean, or your notion, is a good one, because an ocean is in constant movement. And it's this movement that the thought sits on, so to speak, and it takes you where you might not have dreamt you would go. I would like to say that Harold did not write in his own terms anyway in sentences, but rather in units. He did not think in sentences, and he felt this distinguished... That's my slip. That just differentiated him, and in my view distinguished him from most other writers who conceived of their thoughts in sentences. But he found sentences too rigid, too confining, And the grammar of a unit much more open and much broader and able to contain the motion that he tried to get. And that's why he can go in these places, because everything is constantly in movement. Nothing is fixed, nothing is static, and he loathed closure.
And one of the things that I loved talking to him about, this occurred on the telephone after the section of the interview you heard. He was working on the book that was the last book he published during his lifetime, Profane Love.
Profane Friendship.
Profane Friendship, excuse me.
Well, we tossed back and forth Profane Love and Profane Friendship, and Profane Friendship seemed to all of us to be much more exact. Or at least, I should say, semi-exact, to be broadkeeping about it.
He had sent me a manuscript, and what astonished me was that in these long sentences, there were what would be regarded as Hemingway sentences, brief declarative sentences which, when commaed and set adrift in the Brodsky style, would become shimmering, you know, sort of element by element, catching the light. I can't tell you, I loved receiving this manuscript. It was so full of surprises, and one of the, I guess, excitements, but truly indignities of the literary world was that to read what has been made so far of Harold Brodsky by his contemporaries, one would assume that one could not look at these books and find admirable things in them. Anyone who has, of course, knows differently. This is the case of one of the most enormously, I won't even say misunderstood, it's simply rejected consciousnesses working in contemporary literature. Now, you were at his side. I remember saying to him on the phone, you must write about this. And at first, he wasn't going to. He didn't want to. What led him to do an AIDS journal? A death journal.
I think really the idea that he wanted to have the last word about himself. And he also felt that death was an interesting subject, his own included. And he said to me repeatedly, do not look away. This is going to be an adventure for both of us. I want you here with your eyes wide open. We're not going to have any lying, no deathbed stuff. We're going to look at this because this may be the greatest adventure of all. And as I said to friends at the time, life with him was an incredible adventure. And I saw no reason why death would not be equally incredible, perhaps more so, and it was. It was stunning.
Now, he says again and again in this book that his sense of responsibility to you would have been to ask you to leave and let him die on his own.
Yes.
And that your idea of love was to stay with him to the very end, and that this was the subject of enormous contention.
Ah, yes. This was a man, and you have to love a man like this, who, if I didn't do what he wanted or I made decisions that he felt were not in his best interest, would threaten me with a nursing home. Now, a man dying of AIDS, who loves you passionately and whom you love, threatening to go to a nursing home if you won't do what he wants, is too extraordinary and singular an experience to give up, no matter how difficult it became. He was just, you know, a ravishing human being.
Now, fortunately, there were indications, and they're mentioned in this book, that in addition to meaning being various and coming and going, something we'll come back to, that there are many correct versions of Harold Brodsky. In fact, what he says is that it was exhausting to deal with the rejection in America and England and the simultaneous acceptance in Germany and Italy and France, especially in Germany, where he was a literary phenomenon. The book, The Runaway Soul, was a bestseller. His lectures were sellout lectures, readings, you know, standing room only. In fact, what's happened is that his German publisher, Michael Naumann, is now in America associated with Metropolitan Books, which is a division of Holt. And there are to be not one, but how many books posthumous of Harold's?
Well, there's a book of stories coming next. There's also a book, kind of an interesting idea of Michael's, who is, by the way, CEO of Holt now, which is a book of Harold's, excerpts of Harold's thoughts about Venice and descriptions of Venice juxtaposed with black and white photographs of Venice in the 20s and 30s. A small book for lovers of Venice, because Harold wrote so eloquently about Venice. I would put, of course, I'm the worst person in the world to say this because I'm so prejudiced, but I was a fan before I met him, so I think he is equal, if not superior in many ways, to Ruskin on Venice. It's just luminous stuff, so there's going to be that. And then we have plans for a book of essays and down the road letters, and Michael is a partisan, and you know, he wants Harold's work out there.
Now, you've told me that Harold said that it would be easier for his work once he was out of the way.
Yes. Yes. He did. He felt that in many ways he was an enemy of his work as far as facing the public. Well, I shouldn't say the public, because he had a wonderful relationship with his readers and a very loyal following, but the critics and the academics who stood between him and the reading public, and who were determined, most often in this country anyway, to see that his work reached the fewest number of people. So it took a certain bravery and resourcefulness, you know, to read him in the face of all this negative stuff.
I wanted to ask you to read a passage which seems to me to be utterly characteristic, which is about meaning, in this case, the meaning of life and the meaning of death. And there's a Brodkean interpretation involved here. This is Ellen Brodke reading from This Wild Darkness, The Story of My Death by Harold Brodke, published by Metropolitan Books.
I can't remember ever wishing life and death had a perceptible, known, overall meaning. When I was a child, I wished only for life, a little more of it, or much more of it. In the first torments of adolescence, I wished for a little less of it, for peace from it and its dangers. I think of breath as noisy and containing a kind of reason or meaning, as in the half-prayer of "Let me breathe." I think of the mind as rebellious and made of interruptions and demands for the ideal and private flights. It is dangerous to love minds, even one's own. I have accepted since childhood the transience of everything, including meaning, poor orphan that I was. The arrival and departure of significance was something I was used to, not in the sense that the significance appears once and disappears for good, but in the sense that impure versions of it recur as my party-loving parents came and went, dressed and left the house and returned. They return in memory still. This hasn't changed with illness. Death has a transient significance for me, one that changes. My sense of it changes, too. The imagery, the shock along the nerves, the fear or terror behind the breastbone. I tend to treat myself as if I were a nervous dog, a schnauzer, say. It's all right, I say to myself. It's all right. Sometimes it seems to me my blood, my bones, my nerves, my mind, my heart whisper to one another, but not to me. I feel like the dissolving parent of the parts of me that there are. I would like to endow a small chiesa in Venice to be called the Church of Saint Death and the ease of leaving true meaning behind.
Ellen Brodke, reading from This Wild Darkness, The Story of My Death by Harold Brodke. I want to conclude with a question. I know that when Harold would give public readings and he would get overwhelmed, he would turn to you and you would step up and continue the reading for him. And you say that by the end of his life, as he was speaking, when speaking in a murmur, that you could complete his sentences for him. There is a question about devoting one's life in this way. Why did you and do you continue to do it?
It's a rare privilege to be in the company of a person who never lies. Well, Harold would correct me, who almost never lies. He nearly broken me of my habit of absolutist thinking. It's a privilege beyond which I don't think I have the language for expressing it, but it's life-giving not to lie. It's life-giving to hear the truth, even if it's painful beyond belief for long periods of time. And I miss it terribly. I try to do it myself, but I don't have the strength of character or the bravery. He was really a kamikaze to step out there alone and tell the truth and bring down the wrath of the world on his head. I do it because I love literature. I do it because it's brought me... It was because I feel that meeting Harold was my destiny and my story, and because we're surrounded by mediocrity and he wasn't mediocre. And someone has to enable people like this to thrive, to flourish, to grow, to bloom. Someone has to help culture be carried from one generation to another, and it's individual people who do the work for a few months here and a few months there. Believe me, it's not hard. It's joyful.
I've been speaking to Ellen Brodkey on the subject of her late husband Harold Brodkey's story of his death, entitled This Wild Darkness, The Story of My Death. It's interesting. I don't think Harold would have written the story of his life.
I was thinking that today, too. He was forced to come finally to the subject matter and in a sense, for Harold, be brief.
He once announced to me, he would say, I have a theory about Kafka. He said, Kafka is about the relativist, the itinerant relativist, in horrible confrontation with the absolute. This comes very close to the nature of this book, This Wild Darkness, The Story of My Death by Harold Brodkey, published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you for joining me, Ellen.
Oh, thank you for having me here, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Bob Dine.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.